Okay, so for some logistical things, today I want to do course evaluations. So I'm only going to lecture for about 20 minutes. Then I'll stop, I'll pass out the evaluations. And if I could, I need one volunteer who's willing to collect all the evaluations and take them up to the front office, just in front of the elevators on the first floor. I'll have you fill out the evaluations, put them in the envelope, and then somebody can drop it off in MS 401. That would be great. We'll do evaluations today. Homework set 9 is posted on WebAssign. Now, I would try to get those problems done by Monday, because effectively next week is dead week, and so I'm going to finish up with diagonalization today. I'll talk a bit about orthogonality in Friday on Monday. And then Wednesday and Friday next week, we'll just be preparing for the final exam. So we're pretty much through the course, except for one last topic, which will be orthogonality. And I'll talk about that in two lectures on Friday and Monday. What I want to do today is briefly review how we diagonalize matrices, and then I'll give you an example of that calculation, and then I want to give you an application of why it's useful to diagonalize matrices. And what I'll show you today, using basically just linear algebra, that we can solve systems of differential equations once we can diagonalize matrices. Okay, so diagonalization is about taking a square matrix and converting it into a diagonal form, where the only non-zero entries occur along that main diagonal. So in order to do that, what you need is an auxiliary matrix C that, when you do this matrix multiplication on the left, a diagonal matrix is produced. The topic this week has been studying this situation, and what we found is if we have enough eigenvectors for the matrix A, we can use those eigenvectors to create an invertible matrix. And in fact, what will happen is using the eigenvectors of A, using them to create a matrix C, we can get an identity like this, so long, and in fact, the form of this diagonal matrix is already known once we know n invertible or n linearly independent eigenvectors. The diagonal entries of this matrix are just going to be the eigenvalues that correspond to the eigenvectors we use for this matrix C. So more precisely, a square matrix is diagonalizable if and only if we have n linearly independent eigenvectors. That linearly dependence means you don't have parallel eigenvectors. You have really distinct directions. All right, and then the way we get those matrices C and D is, first of all, we have to solve the eigenvector eigenvalue problem for A. So we get a bunch of eigenvectors and their corresponding eigenvalues. Each of these eigenvectors is going to obey one of these eigenvalue equations. And then what we do is we simply use the eigenvectors. We use those to form the matrix C, and we use the eigenvalues to form the diagonal entries of a diagonal matrix, and these should be correlated. This is an eigenvector of A, and so it's going to obey an equation like this. Since it corresponds to the first column, we want to use the corresponding eigenvalue in that first slot. The second column is also going to be an eigenvector. We'll want to use an eigenvalue, say lambda 2, in that second slot there. So the columns here and the diagonal entries here are correlated via equations like that. Now, what we need to diagonalize is an invertible matrix. And so this matrix C, if I use the same vector over and over again, the columns would not be linearly independent and the matrix would not be invertible. And so what we need are a total of n linearly independent eigenvectors. Then the matrix C we construct from them, its columns are going to be linearly independent, and so it'll be invertible. and we will be able to diagonalize A using such a matrix. All right, now, so the basic condition, in order to diagonalize a matrix A, the basic thing you need are enough linearly independent eigenvectors. There's several ways you can detect whether or not you will have enough before you actually solve the eigenvector eigenvalue problem for A. For example, if you have a square matrix and you've calculated its characteristic polynomial, you do this in order to find the eigenvalues. Once you've calculated this determinant, you get a polynomial that will factorize, and these numbers R1, R2, up to Rk, these are going to be exactly your eigenvalues. The number of factors of lambda minus an eigenvalue that occurs in the characteristic polynomial, that we've called the algebraic multiplicity of the eigenvalue. And what we showed last time, that is, if these eigenvalues R1 through Ak are all distinct, meaning the corresponding number of times these factors of lambda minus an eigenvalue occur in the characteristic polynomial, if these are all ones, then in fact, you're going to have n distinct eigenvalues. Each one of those is going to have a linearly independent eigenvector, and so you will have enough linearly independent eigenvectors to diagonalize A. So if each of these eigenvalues only occurs with multiplicity 1, then we're guaranteed that A is diagonalizable. Alternatively, another way of checking is you have to dig a little bit deeper. You're going to have to actually not only find the eigenvalues, but you have to find a basis for the corresponding eigenspaces. If those geometric multiplicities, here this dimension E subscript Ri, this is the Ri eigenspace. It's the space of all vectors in Rn such that the vectors are an eigenvector of A with eigenvalue Ri. So that's a subspace of Rn. We calculate its dimension by finding a basis for that subspace. And this number mu subscript I is exactly the number of linearly independent eigenvectors you have with that particular eigenvalue. Now these multiplicities, they're always going to add up to n. But the number of eigenvectors you can get for a given eigenvalue, that could be less than the number of factors you have here. And in fact, if any one of these numbers is less than the corresponding algebraic multiplicity, then you will not have enough eigenvectors to diagonalize A. On the other hand, if these geometric multiplicities are all equal to the algebraic multiplicities, then these numbers are going to add up to n just like these numbers do, and you will have enough linearly independent eigenvectors. And a third condition that I mentioned just at the end of the lecture on Monday was that if a matrix is symmetric, meaning when you convert its rows into columns and you just reproduce the original matrix, then those matrices are always diagonalizable as well. I point this example out because this condition is often very frequently natural in a physical context. And so often in a physical problem where you have to diagonalize a matrix, it's going to be guaranteed to be diagonalizable because the matrix you're looking at is symmetric. All right, so that's reviewing what we covered on Monday and Friday of last week. Let's do a quick example where we diagonalize a matrix. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to answer the question of whether or not A is diagonalizable before I actually find two linearly independent eigenvectors in order to diagonalize it. So we're still looking for a matrix C that will convert A to a diagonal matrix. The first thing I'll do is I'll solve the eigenvector. I'll find the eigenvalues of A. So we take the determinant of A minus lambda times I, so-called characteristic polynomial. What happened here? Is I took the matrix A, which was 5 minus 1, 2, 2, and I calculate the determinant of A minus lambda times I, that's going to be the determinant of 5 minus lambda, negative 1, 2, 2 minus lambda. And then this determinant is just the 2 by 2 matrix, so its determinant is going to be the difference of the product along those, the main diagonal and the opposite diagonal. And so here you have the product of diagonal entries and then the product of the cross diagonal minus the difference of this diagonal product, which will be 2. You'll get 5 minus lambda times 2 minus lambda plus 2. And then that simplifies to this quadratic polynomial. And you can see sort of the factorization here. You're looking for factors of this thing that add up to this number. And 3 and 4 add up to 7, and they multiply together to produce 12. So that's the correct factorization of the characteristic polynomial. And having achieved that factorization, we can now identify the eigenvalues of A as either being 3 or 4, because those are the values of lambda for which that polynomial is equal to 0. All right, so we've got two different eigenvalues. Because we have a 2 by 2 matrix, each one of these eigenvalues is going to give us at least one linearly independent eigenvector. So I have two linearly independent eigenvectors. The matrix will be diagonalizable. So I didn't actually have to find the eigenvectors to conclude that it's diagonalizable. It's because I have as many distinct eigenvalues as I have dimensions of this matrix. That's how I know it's diagonalizable. Let's go ahead and diagonalize it then. Once we found the eigenvalues, so to diagonalize an n by n matrix A, first of all, you find the eigenvalues. And in the case at hand, for this matrix, we found we had two eigenvalues, lambda equal to 3 and lambda equal 4. And then the next step is to find bases for the corresponding eigenspace. So this E subscript RI is the RI eigenspace. And what that is, it's actually all the vectors X inside Rn. So here I'm working with an n by n matrix. So it's going to be the vectors in Rn such that A times X is equal to RI times X. It's going to consist of all the eigenvectors of matrix A with that given eigenvalue. But it's also equal to, and this is how we calculate it, it's the null space of A minus RI times the identity matrix. And so actually to find these basis vectors for the eigenspace, we have to solve a linear system. And that we do in the usual fashion. We take the coefficient matrix, row reduced to reduced row echelon form, and from that reduced row echelon form of the coefficient matrix, we try to extract solution vectors. All right, so let's work it out in detail for this example here. So my first eigenvalue is 3. So what I'm going to do then to find the corresponding eigenvectors, I'm going to look at A minus 3 times the identity matrix and think of that as a coefficient matrix for a linear system. All right, so that's that guy. When I subtract 3 from the diagonal elements of A, 5 minus 3 is 2, 2 minus 3 is negative 1. So that explains those entries. But what I want is the solution set of this matrix times X is equal to 0. Well, what I'll do is I didn't quite go to reduced row echelon form here, but I can. Here I've got it in row echelon form, A minus 3i is equal to 2 minus 1, 2 minus 1. And if we go all the way to reduce row echelon form, what happens is that, first of all, I can kill off this bottom row by subtracting the first row from it. And then I make the pivot equal to 1. I'll have 1 minus 1 half, 0, 0, as the reduced row echelon form of this matrix. Now I've got a coefficient matrix in reduced row echelon form. I convert back to equations. And so the equations coming from this matrix are going to be x1 minus 1 half x2 is equal to 0. And the second row is telling me that 0 is equal to 0. Since this is in row echelon form, I know that the second column, because it does not contain a pivot, here's the only pivot in that matrix. Since it does not contain a pivot, it's gonna, x2 is going to be a free parameter. So I take the equations, and I use them to express the fixed variable corresponding to columns with pivots in terms of free variables, columns without pivots. We get x1 is equal to 1 half x2. And then once I know this relationship between the components of the solution vector, then I write down x equals, well, for x1, I can use 1 half x2. For x2, I just use itself. It's a free parameter. And then I think of this as x2 times 1 half 1. All right, so there's a bunch of really tiny calculations that go from this writing down this matrix, row reducing it to row echelon form, and then getting the basis vectors for the solution set of this matrix times x is equal to 0. And what we find is those solution vectors are all proportional to this basis vector, 1 half 1. That guy there, the vector that you generates all the eigenvectors with eigenvalue 3 for the given matrix, that's our eigenvector. What one often does, though, so we can deal with vectors without fractions in them, is I can take this vector and multiply it by 2 to get a vector with just integer entries. But this vector generates the same space as this, so it's still just as good a basis vector. So we'll use the vector 1, 2 as the basis vector for the eigenspace corresponding to the eigenvalue lambda equals 3. And that takes care of the analysis of the lambda equals 3 eigenspace. But we have another eigenvector, so we'll have to do the same thing. We now subtract the second eigenvalue from A along its diagonal, produces this matrix. We row reduce this matrix to reduced row echelon form. We'll get this matrix. And then we convert back to equations, expand the, get equations for the components from that matrix, and then express the free parameters in terms of, express the variables corresponding to columns with pivots. We express them in terms of variables that don't corresponding to columns without pivots. We get these relations, we write down a solution vector, and then we expand in terms of the free parameter to get our basis vector. And so similar calculation is repeated here. And in this, for this eigenspace, we find that it's generated by a single vector with components 1, 1. By the way, I want to point something out here. You notice in both cases, whether I'm looking at the 3 eigenspace or the 4 eigenspace, in this row reduction, you start off with a matrix that has lots of non-zero entries. But what should always happen if you properly identify the eigenvalue, when you row reduce A minus its eigenvalue times the identity matrix, when you row reduce that, you should always get a zero row at the bottom. If you're not getting that, go back and check your calculation because you've made some kind of numerical error. You always have to have a zero row here because the eigenvectors that we're looking for have to be non-zero vectors. If this matrix ended up being row reducible to the identity matrix, let's take a larger system. Suppose A minus lambda times I, suppose that row reduces. If it row reduces to the identity matrix, then when you convert back to equations, it's going to tell us that x1 is equal to 0, x2 is equal to 0, and xn is equal to 0, which means you only have the 0 vector. So you don't want it to row reduce to the identity matrix. So how can you prevent this from row reducing? Well, you start off maybe constructing thing, and maybe when you reach this column, suddenly you expect a pivot here, but you don't have it there. And so maybe you have a column like this, where you're dropping down in the stairwise staircase, but then you get to a column where you skip over before you reach the next pivot. Well, what's going to happen here, because these are square matrices, you've kind of, here you're jumping down one step over, one step down, one step over, one step down. But now you're jumping over one step over and two steps down. So what's going to happen is you continue to fill out this diagonal matrix. You're going to reach this end before you reach the bottom of the matrix. And so if you had a column without a pivot, meaning you had one free parameter in your row echelon form, it would mean you'd be missing a pivot. And it's got to come from one of the rows. When we go in row echelon form, we put the zero rows at the very bottom of a matrix. So what should always happen as you're trying to find these eigenspaces and you row reduce A minus the eigenvalue times the identity matrix, that row reduction should always produce a zero row at the bottom. If it doesn't, you've made a mistake. And the mistake would have been you've improperly identified the eigenvalue. Okay, so that's how you do it. And we do exactly the same thing as for the eigenvalue 4 as we did for the eigenvalue 3. We express solutions of A minus 4i, 4 times I, x equals 0. We see that they're all proportional to this vector, so we call that vector the eigenvector of A with eigenvalue 4. And now that I've got two eigenvalues that are corresponding eigenvectors, that's all I need to write down the matrix C that converts A into the diagonal matrix. I form C by taking the eigenvectors and using them as columns. These are linearly independent vectors, so this matrix that I create that way is going to be automatically be invertible. And moreover, C is, you can use that now to convert the original matrix into a diagonal matrix. That diagonal matrix is going to be exactly this matrix. It's going to be diagonal, and its diagonal entries are going to be the eigenvalues corresponding to the corresponding eigenvectors. So that first column gives you that, and what I use in this first diagonal entry is the eigenvector corresponding to that the column I use. So the eigenvector was 3. So that's why I put 3 there. For the second column, its eigenvalue is 2, so I use, its eigenvalue is 4, so I use 4 for the second diagonal entry of D. Once I've solved the eigenvector eigenvalue problem for A, I can immediately write down the matrix C that converts A into a diagonal matrix, and I can simultaneously write down that matrix, that diagonal matrix D. Okay. So what I want to talk about next is an application of this stuff. We're going to solve a differential, a system of differential equations by diagonalizing a matrix. So here's the kind of system I'm interested in. I have two variables, two functions that I'm trying to find, x1 of t and x2 of t. I'm going to postulate that they be a differential equation, where the time derivative x1 depends on both x1 and x2, as does the time derivative of x2, it depends on both x1 and x2. We call these coupled differential equations because we actually have two unknown functions. They're separated on the left-hand side here, but their derivatives are actually proportional to both functions. So these kind of differential equations are really common. in chemistry, suppose you had hydrogen interacting with oxygen, and you want to know the rate at which that reaction is proceeding. Well, it sort of makes sense that the rate at which the hydrogen is burning up, it's going to be proportional to how much hydrogen you have, but it also needs to interact with the oxygen in order to, you know, form the water molecule. And so the rate at which the concentration of hydrogen is changing would be proportional to how much hydrogen you have, but also to how much oxygen you have to burn with it. And similarly, the oxygen, its rate of depletion would be proportional to how much hydrogen is to the burn and how much oxygen there is to mix. So this would be sort of a natural differential equation that would govern the rate at which hydrogen and oxygen, where their concentrations are changing as they burn. But a similar kind of system, you know, you could think of in biology, or more precisely maybe ecology, where you're considering two species, a predator and a prey. And if the two species left each other alone, then their birth rate, or the rate at which the population changes, would be proportional to the size of the population at any given time. So many rabbits are producing so rapidly. But if there's a predator in the system as well, the foxes can eat the rabbits, and so they could decrease the rabbit population. And on the other hand, if X2 represents the fox population, it has a greater food supply, so it could grow quicker. And so systems like this could also govern predator and prey. And like so many things in ecology, they have a reflection in the stock market as well. If you have two equities and one sort of depends on the growth of another equity, you get differential equations like this in financial situations. You get differential equations of the same form when you have oscillators, like a bunch of springs that are connected to one another. They'll work out, their equations of motion will work out to be coupled systems. Electrical engineering, if you have circuits that consist of an inductor, a resistor, and a capacitor, if you trace around the voltages as you transverse that circuit, you get differential equations for that as well. So the upshot is that these sort of simple systems of differential equations are really common. What they don't teach you in Math 2233, though, is how to solve these systems. So I'll show you. The reason why they don't teach it in 2233 is that they don't assume that you've had any linear algebra yet. But now let's use some linear algebra. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take these two functions and I'm going to encapsulate them as a single vector value function. So now for each value of t, I have two component functions to determine. And I'll take these coefficients, a11, so this is the coefficient of the first unknown function in the first equation, coefficient of the second unknown function in the second equation. I can use these to form a coefficient matrix in the usual fashion. And then my differential equation can be written in vector notation as the derivative of the two components x1 and x2 are equal to this matrix times the same column vector. And that's just restating the original differential equations component by component. All right, so we're going to solve these systems, but the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to solve a very simple case when my coefficient matrix is a diagonal matrix. In this situation, solving the corresponding differential equations is really easy. When the matrix is diagonal, we say that the system is decoupled, because what's going to happen here, here's the vector form of the differential equation equals ax, or more explicitly, d dt x1 in the first component, d dt x2 in the second component, is equal to this coefficient matrix a11, a12, a21, a 2-2 times x1, x2. All right, so this is just taking, and if you look at this component by component, you actually calculate this matrix product, it will be a11, x1 plus a12, x2, a21, x1 plus a22, x2. So this matrix reformulation of the problem is the same set of differential equations. The first component, dx1 is equal to coefficient times x1 plus another coefficient times x2. Because the equation corresponding to the comparing the second component on both sides is just the second of the original differential equations. All right, now, when this matrix is diagonal, though, that means that term would equal 0 and that term would equal 0. What happens is the differential equations completely decouple, meaning the derivative of x1 only depends on x1 and the derivative of x2 only, sorry, this is not the term that drops out. This one drops out, a22. This one depends only on the second thing. And so the differential equations themselves decouple and we can solve them independently. These differential equations are really easy. You should know the solution of this from calculus, because when you differentiate an exponential function, you just bring down the factor that's being multiplied by the variable inside the exponential function. So any function of this form is going to satisfy this equation, and any exponential function of this form is going to satisfy the second equation. The upshot, and what I'm saying here, is if the matrix is diagonalizable, there's not much work to be done in order to write down the solution. But that's not the case we're interested in. We want the case when A is not diagonal, but let's assume that it's at least diagonalizable. And so we're dealing with a matrix that may have non-zero off-diagonal components, but we'll assume that this matrix, even though it's not diagonal, it's capable of being diagonalized by finding its eigenvalues and its eigenvectors and using those to construct a matrix C that will diagonalize A. So that using the eigenvectors of A, we can create C, and doing this matrix multiplication of A by C and its inverse will produce that diagonal matrix. All right, so what I'm going to do to solve this problem is I'm going to assume that I already know the solution to the eigenvector eigenvalue problem for the matrix A. So assume we found eigenvalues lambda 1 and lambda 2 and their eigenvectors. Say V1 and V2. And so with this data, we can diagonalize the matrix A. Then we can create C, V1, V2 with C the minus first times A times C is equal to a diagonal matrix where those diagonal entries are going to be exactly the eigenvalues of A. So I'm going to assume that I've done all of this calculation for the given coefficient matrix. But that's not my issue. My issue is to solve this differential equation. So what I want to show you is how you can use this eigenvector eigenvalue calculation or the solution of this diagonalization problem, how I can use that to produce solutions of this equation. And it's really pretty easy. What I first do is instead of solving this differential equation, I relate it to a different differential equation where I use this diagonal matrix. So let y of t be the solution of not the equation we want, but rather d dt y is equal to this diagonal matrix times y. The reason why that's useful is because we already know the solution here. If this is a diagonal matrix, 0, lambda 2 times y1 and y2, then this differential equation decouples, and we know the solution vector is going to be, well, one of the equation for y1 is going to decouple from y2, and its solution is going to be the corresponding exponential function times an arbitrary constant in the first component. In the second component, going to be c2. That second diagonal entry is going to give me the right exponential function, and this function is going to satisfy this differential equation. I can write it down. I can write down this solution as soon as I know what these diagonal entries are. But now what I'm going to do is I'm going to claim, if I take the given solution that I just found and I multiply it by this diagonal matrix C, so X of T is going to be this diagonalizing matrix, the one that diagonalizes the coefficient matrix, times the simple solution to it, the decoupled differential equation. This is a solution of dx dt is equal to ax. So that's how I solved this original system where the matrix is non-diagonal. And it's easy to see how that works. First of all, because we have a diagonal system, we can readily solve this differential equation. Here's its solution. Now I'm going to take the solution we just found, this particular vector, and I'm going to multiply it by the matrix C that diagonalizes our original coefficient matrix. So let me show you that this vector, or this vector valued function, satisfies the differential equation. So dx of t is defined to be this. And then this derivative, these entries here are all constant. They don't depend on time. And so this differentiation is going to treat this constant matrix as if it were a constant, and it'll just move right through, and you end up differentiating y of t. But y of t, it obeys this differential equation. So the derivative of y is going to be d times y. Now replace that there. Now I'm going to do something. I have d dt of x of t. I've got it set equal to c times that diagonal matrix times my simple solution. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to insert the identity matrix in between these two factors. But the way I'm going to write the identity matrix is as c the minus first times c times y of t. All right? If I insert the identity matrix between these two factors, nothing changes. Let me write that identity matrix as a product of c and its inverse. And then I'll just regroup things different. C, d, c the minus first times c, y of t. And I guess the c times y of t, that's how we form this guy. I suppose I declared this to be the conjugating matrix times my solution to the decoupled problem. And so that's just x. And then this here turns out to be exactly a, because we have c the minus first a times c is equal to d. That's how we diagonalize a. But if I multiply from the left by c on both sides, and I multiply both sides from the right by the inverse, what's going to happen? Here we'll get a factor of 1. Here c times c the minus first is going to give a factor of 1. And then here we'll have c d c the minus first, or a is equal to c d c the minus first. So basically I'm taking The diagonalization condition, which expresses the diagonal matrix as a product of C minus first times A times C, and I'm solving for A. That means A is equal to C, D, C the minus first. That's exactly this factor. And so what I've shown you is that when I solve the decouple problem, that's easy, and I multiply it by the matrix that converts A into its diagonal form, I simultaneously end up solving the original differential equation, because now this vector I create by, this is the solution of the decoupled system, multiplying by the matrix that converts the coefficient matrix into the diagonal matrix, I end up coming up with a function, a vector value function that satisfies the original linear system. So let me phrase this. Oops, I'm running out of time. Let me phrase this more generally. If you had a system of coupled ordinary differential equation, the way you would solve it is, first of all, you would diagonalize the coefficient matrix. That will give you a bunch of linearly independent eigenvectors and their corresponding eigenvalues. And you can create the matrix C that converts A into the diagonal matrix in the usual way. Then you solve the decoupled system, but that's really easy because for each diagonal entry, you're going to have an exponential solution, and you simply write those exponential solutions in the same order as they appear, these numbers appear diagonally. And then to get the solution of the original problem, where you have a non-diagonal matrix, you take the solution here, which is easy to write down, you multiply it by your diagonalizing matrix, and then you get a solution to the system dx dt is equal to this matrix A times x, and you're done. Okay, so I just wanted to give you a concrete example of how outside this course you'll begin to use some of this apparatus. I'll stop here today. Let me pass out the course evaluations, and then whoever is last to finish their evaluation, if you could once you're done, stick your evaluations inside this yellow envelope, and then the last one to turn it in, if you can simply walk the envelope up to the end of the hallway up there, in front of the elevators, is the math office, and just drop off the envelope there. That would be great.